loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll discuss the surprise delay in the sentencing of former National Security Advisor General Mike Flynn and the way his case is being presented in the media. And then we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump has decided to shut down his embattled and much criticized personal charitable foundation amid allegations that he used it for personal and political gain. New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood said the president had also agreed to give away the remaining money. She added that the foundation had engaged in what she called, quote, a shocking pattern of illegality, unquote. Next, headlines in all major U.S. newspapers and news websites today crowed about the firing of former CBS chief Les Moonves for sexual misconduct. But even in this Me Too era, nearly every headline mentioned Moonves' loss of a $120 million severance package, but did not mention the accusations against him. Then, U.S. negotiators in Abu Dhabi yesterday met with members of the Taliban leadership and representatives of the Afghan government to discuss a possible peace in Afghanistan. It's possible that the Taliban and government delegations could meet face-to-face for the first time. The talks were supposed to last one day, but they've stretched into a second, raising hopes of substantive advances. And then in a speech marking the 40th anniversary of China's economic reform, President Xi Jinping vowed to continue market liberalization, but made no major policy announcements. He asserted the importance of strong Communist Party control of the economy and society, and said in a reference to the United States that no master can control the Chinese people. Meanwhile, the intelligence chiefs of the Five Eyes countries met in Nova Scotia to discuss Chinese electronics giant Huawei. And finally, the Trump administration earlier this year laid out plans to weaken emission controls on vehicles. The changes were so dramatic that even automakers balked at the notion of making and selling dirtier cars and trucks. But it turns out that another group was behind the push. The New York Times reports that it was U.S. oil companies leading the charge to allow cars and trucks to emit more pollution. And in other headlines, the Trump administration announced today a move to ban bump stocks, a firearm accessory that effectively turns semi-automatic weapons into automatic weapons. The Justice Department cited a federal law banning machine guns to justify the move. Bump stocks will be illegal to possess beginning in March. A ceasefire went into effect in the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah today as a result of an agreement negotiated between the U.S. and Saudi-backed government of President Hadi and the Houthi rebels. The deal aims to avert a humanitarian catastrophe caused by a loss of goods coming into the city's port. The ceasefire is one of several steps toward peace taken in recent days, including the agreement in principle to conduct a large-scale prisoner exchange. Debate on the First Step Act was closed today in the Senate by a vote of 82-12, with a vote on the bill that could be as soon as today. The First Step Act is a criminal justice reform bill for the federal system, and the Senate version would reduce mandatory minimum sentences for some drug crimes, expand mandatory minimums for some violent crimes, and increase the amount of good time that some people already serving in prison could earn to facilitate an earlier release. President Trump signed an order today officially creating the Space Command. This move sets the stage for the creation of a space force that will seek to extend U.S. military dominance into outer space. The administration will now look for a commander for the new force. He will hold the rank of four-star general. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the sentencing of Mike Flynn, a federal judge in Washington today. Delayed the highly anticipated sentencing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn for lying to the FBI as part of the Mueller investigation related to lobbying he conducted on behalf of the Turkish government. Prosecutors had asked for leniency because of the degree to which Flynn cooperated in the Mueller probe, but Judge Emmett Sullivan's incendiary comments during the hearing led to the sentencing being delayed. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent who, in 2002, was named Time Magazine Person of the Year along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of a new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of elections around the world. Dan Cavalla, Colleen Raleigh, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, I have to say, we've been looking forward to the Flynn hearing because last week, Judge Emmett Sullivan, in response to Flynn's lawyers filing with the court, demanded that the government come forward with all of the documents related to the 302, the form filed by the Department of Justice or the FBI about their interviews with Michael Flynn. The way this was presented, or the way we thought this would turn out last week, is that Sullivan was angry with the government, angry with the prosecutors. He has a record of this because he threw out the Ted Stevens prosecution for prosecutorial misconduct a few years ago. We thought, wow, Judge Sullivan is setting this up to really punch at the government prosecutors, but he was punching at a different target this morning.
Yes, he reacted in a way really that was the opposite of what I had expected. And as you say, Brian, we've followed this thing quite closely. The judge said some very incendiary things. First of all, when Flynn walked in the room, the mood was one of joviality, CNN has reported. He smiled at friends and family members. He gave them the thumbs up. He shouted, "Thanks for coming. I see you made it." Everybody seemed to think that this was the end of the road. It was all going to be behind him in just a few minutes. And then that's not the way it turned out. When Flynn was called to the podium, to the lectern, to answer some questions that the judge had before sentencing, the judge began by saying, "I want to be frank with you. This crime is very serious. Not only did you lie to the FBI, you lied to the American people, and you lied to senior Trump officials." Well, I think he didn't expect that. He didn't see it coming. And it got a little worse. The judge went on to say, "All along, you were an unregistered agent of a foreign country while serving as the national security advisor to the president of the United States. That undermines everything this flag over here stands for. Arguably, you sold your country out. I am not hiding my disgust, Mr. Flynn, my disdain for your criminal offenses." And Flynn just responded, "Yes, Your Honor." Clearly, he was shocked by this. The judge then went on to ask him twice if Flynn wanted to delay sentencing. Twice, the attorney said that they did not want to delay sentencing because the prosecution had said several times, including in writing in the pre-sentencing report, that Flynn had met with them 19 separate times and provided information that was instrumental to the Mueller investigation. And so Flynn believed today that his reward would be no prison time. Well, things weren't turning out the way he had expected. So as it turned out, while Flynn was standing at the lectern taking these questions, the judge said that his conduct had risen to the level of treasonous activity. Those were his words. Treasonous activity. Now, it didn't. He was only charged with lying to the FBI, and treason is providing aid and comfort to the enemy in a time of war. But then he called the prosecutor, Brandon Van Grack, to speak on behalf of the special counsel's office, and he asked Van Grack, should he have been charged with treason? And Van Grack declined to answer the question. So then Flynn's attorneys asked for a short recess. It was a 15-minute recess that ended up going about 45 minutes. When they all came back into the courtroom, the judge apologized for using the word treason, and he said that he didn't want to imply that Flynn had committed treason, but he wanted to know if the behavior was treasonous behavior. You can draw your own line there. I'm not really sure what his point was. And then finally, Flynn's attorney did ask for that that delay. And so Flynn won't be sentenced until sometime in March. We still have no idea what the sentence will be. If I had to make a guess today, I'd say based on what we saw in court, he's going to do some prison time. But the idea behind the delay is that he'll continue to cooperate with the Mueller people, and he'll be such a good soldier, no pun intended, that when March comes, the judge, they're hoping, will have a change of heart.
Colleen Raleigh, pretty remarkable and dramatic set of circumstances. Again, not what we had really anticipated today. What was your take?
Well, this is a little bit of a educated guess, and no one knows what these facts are behind the scenes. But judges do engage from time to time in ex parte communications for different reasons. And it would be my, again, educated guess that it was nothing in the 302 notes, the interview notes that the judge, demanded be provided by the FBI. And all, like I said, all the documents regarding the interview of Flynn. My guess is it would have been nothing in those notes that would have suddenly changed the judge's demeanor or, you know, his stance on this. But it may have been some kind of ex parte communication, possibly. You know, it's just, I'll tell you why I think this, because normally, and just as background, the way that the FBI conducts interviews and then transcribes those interviews in their own words, called an FD-302, goes back to J. Edgar Hoover. The reason that the FBI has long, long resisted tape recording interviews and even including confessions. When I was working in the 90s, the director, Louis Free, was told by a judge, asked by a federal judge, why doesn't the FBI tape record confessions so you don't have this problem on the witness stand where the agent says, yes, he confessed, and the subject, the defendant, says, no, I didn't. So the judge says, why don't you just avoid that and do like most other law enforcement in the country is now doing, because now the equipment exists to easily tape record. And Director Free said, well, you're right. I don't know why the FBI is so backward that they're just letting agents write these things in their own words. But what happened is there was an outcry inside the FBI by all the special agents in charge. And they went back to the Hoover practice of never tape recording anything. Now, just in the last two or three years, when Comey was director, he relaxed it. And I think now they can tape record confessions. But so, for instance, in this Flynn interview, which, you know, I'm just going to say something else here. It is quite easy and quite unremarkable that on the first attempt at interviewing a suspect, I'm trying to say this in a backward way, but in almost all cases that I'm aware of, and I conducted, you know, hundreds of interviews with mafia and everybody else, in almost all cases, even cooperating witnesses do not tell the truth. And this is the common, you know, it's actually the rare case where a person would tell the full truth.
Wow.
And so that's, you have to understand that. And the reason why those are not prosecuted in the past, they were never prosecuted for these little things. It would be the rare case when this old Title 18, 1001 lying to the FBI was actually prosecuted. And usually it was only in a case where there was a serious underlying crime. Not in Flynn's case, there's no even underlying crime, let alone not a serious underlying crime. Contacting the Russian ambassador was not even a crime, let alone a serious one. But let's say there was a really serious violent crime and the statute of limitations had passed or something like that. That would have been a candidate for prosecuting Title 18, 1001 lying to the FBI. But it almost was never, ever even prosecuted. And in fact, there was a Supreme Court case in early 2001 or two that opened the door to more prosecution, because before this, it was thought by courts that you couldn't prosecute 1001 if it was a mere denial of having committed the crime, because they said it would violate your right against self-incrimination. Anyways, it's very complicated, and this case is very, very bizarre.
Yeah, that's the voice of Colleen Raleigh. Colleen is the former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year along with two other whistleblowers. We're also joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of a new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, I want to, again, I think context here is important because people's eyes start to glaze over and forget key details. So I want to just identify what some of those key details are and then ask your opinion as an attorney. So here we had Michael Flynn, the national security advisor in waiting. This was during the transition between the November election and January 20th when Trump takes office. He's calling members of the UN Security Council, their diplomatic corps, not on behalf of Russia, but on behalf of Israel, asking each and every member of the Security Council, including Russia, to delay or vote no on a resolution that would condemn Israel for establishing illegal settlements in the West Bank. Now, the Israelis were desperate to have that happen because the Obama administration was going to abstain, which meant if America abstained and nobody else vetoed it, Israel would be condemned by the UN. So Flynn calls all these ambassadors, including the Russian ambassador, and he did it after talking to Jared Kushner. Now, on January 24th, 4 days after Flynn becomes National Security Advisor, Andrew McCabe, who later gets fired from the FBI and who had been in charge of the Russia investigation and the Hillary Clinton investigation of her email server, he calls Flynn up. And Flynn and McCabe, or Flynn thinks, according to the FBI, that they're all on the same team. And it's a fun discussion, a leisurely discussion. And at the end of it, about other things, at the end of it, Andrew McCabe says to Flynn, hey, we have a couple agents who'd like to come over and talk to you about this Russia thing. And he discourages Flynn from getting a lawyer. He says, no, it'll just be too complicated. Just talk to us without a lawyer. Flynn says, sure, come on over. So the two agents come over, including Peter Strzok, whatever, however you pronounce his name. They come over and they investigate or they interview Michael Flynn. He gives them a tour of the White House. They say he's in a jocular mood. Now, before they went over, they knew exactly what Flynn said to the Russian ambassador in those conversations. They knew it because they had the transcripts from probably the NSA. They knew it exactly. So there was no mystery that they were going to uncover. They didn't want him to have a lawyer. He talks to them, and at some point, he talks about what happened in his discussion with the Russian ambassador in a way either by omission or commission. He doesn't tell the full truth. And as Colleen Raleigh was saying, like, very rarely does anyone tell the full truth. So now it seems to me that we have a prescient moment because it goes to the intent. Why did Andrew McCabe, with the support of James Comey, go and interview Michael Flynn, discourage him from having a lawyer, already knowing exactly what he said to the Russian ambassador? And why did they do that except for to set him up, to entrap him? Which shows that the intent was to bring him down, not to help solve a problem. Anyway, it seems to me that this goes to the essence of the Russiagate conspiracy, so-called, because it shows that the FBI actually did have intent and an agenda, and it wasn't about correcting a crime. It was to bring down Flynn to get at least the ball rolling in terms of unraveling the Trump administration along these lines. Go ahead.
Yes, well, I think that is true. I think all along the goal has been to find anything that they can pin on anyone in the Trump administration that smacks of alleged collusion with Russia. And the fact that Flynn met with the Russian ambassador at least smacks of that or smells of that. But, of course, the interesting part of it, there's a couple interesting parts. One, he wasn't there as an agent of Russia. He was really there more as an agent of Israel to help Israel. And so it has less to do with Russia than it does with Israel, number one. Number two, to meet with a foreign ambassador when you are on the transition team of an incoming administration is pretty common. In fact, it makes a lot of sense. You know, there's this time period between November and January that the incoming administration has to prepare itself for many duties, including foreign policy duties. And so it's very common for the new team to start meeting with people, meeting with U.S. Congress people, and meeting with foreign diplomats. That's exactly what Flynn did. Again, not out of the usual. And so it seems that the FBI then went out of its way to try to get him for something else. And that is, as you say, not giving the full picture or telling something less than truthful about his meeting with the Russian ambassador. And that is what they're getting him for.
I have to say, I was surprised this morning when I heard an interview with a retired general on NPR in which the interviewer asked him essentially the same question. And he said that Mike Flynn should have known better. I'm a former general, too, he said, and I would never have met with a foreign national without reporting it to the FBI. Well, you're the incoming national security advisor. Your job is to meet with foreign diplomats and foreign nationals. You're not going to report it to the FBI because you do it for a living. This just didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, he called the Russian ambassador. He called him twice. The first one was about the resolution at the United Nations. So yeah, he calls them as I mentioned, he called all the Security Council members. Like, they're not protesting that Flynn called France.
No.
Or the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the Russian narrative. So Colleen, again, when we look at the thing, there was another part to it that I want you to help us understand, because you were there. You know what the F-302 is, I guess, the form. After Stroke and the other person from the FBI interviewed Michael Flynn on January 24th, there's now transcripts of them communicating with Lisa Page in the general counsel's office at the FBI. And this was in mid-February. And the thing is the 302 ready to go? And she says, launch the 302, mean filing the report. Now, Flynn's lawyers last week filed before Judge Sullivan in their statement, in their motion to the court. They asked the question, were there other documents that had been withheld? Because the government has also indicated that the date for the 302, the F-302, was August 22nd, 6 or 7 months after we have Peter Stroke communicating with Lisa Page about the 302. So the implication is that the 302 was issued again. It was amended. It was edited. It was also, again, according to the memorandum from the prosecution, it was in August 22nd. That's after Peter Stroke was fired by Mueller for being part of the Mueller probe after his incriminating text with Lisa Page, where it clearly showed political bias against Trump. Just explain, is that common that 302s could be revised, could be amended?
I would say it's not common, but in this case, something is not meeting the eye. There's really, I can see why there should be some concern for the looks and the kind of the smell of this. It's just not correct. One of the reasons it's not correct is because when you are merely transcribing an interview in your own words, you're supposed to be accurate, of course. And the reason there was a rule when I worked, I mean, this was, again, it goes back to J. Edgar Hoover. The old rule was that the interview had to be done in 5 days. The reason it had to be done in 5 days was going back to the accuracy. Your mind, after a month or two or 6 months, if you're trying to transcribe something that was said to you 6 months before, it's going to allow a lot more inaccuracy than if there's a rule that you have to put it to paper in a very quick fashion. So again, these dates are not adding up at all, and I have no way of really even making an educated guess as to why and how they are not adding up. Obviously, it would be quite improper to revise 302s. You know, once they're written, again, you go back, we could avoid all of this if the FBI would merely get into the 21st century and start tape recording, as most law enforcement does. But they insist on doing this old-fashioned transcribing in our own words, because it favors the prosecution. If you get into a he said, she said before a jury, the jury is almost always going to believe the agent over the defendant. So they have retained this old fashioned thing. The only safeguard was a 5 days that it had to be on paper. And why this would show a date months later is beyond me. I have no, really no clue.
Dan Kovalik, Judge Emmett Sullivan, in the beginning today of the Flynn sentencing, said, you know, he suggested he was a traitor, that he was working for a foreign country. He was, of course, we know he belatedly registered as a foreign agent for Turkey because he and his associates were doing lobbying for the Turkish government, and he wasn't registered as a foreign agent. One of the things that I noticed, and I was talking to John about this, is that the media coverage of Sullivan's comments suggesting that Flynn might be a traitor. And again, Sullivan walked that all back after he came back and said, oh, I didn't mean to say you were a traitor. Well, yeah, that's what you said, Judge Sullivan. You said, should he be charged as a traitor? Then the media is reporting, judge says that he is a traitor or working for a foreign power, that he went against his own country. But none of the media coverage, Dan, the stories I saw, we saw 6 or 7 of them. None of those said it's about Turkey, meaning in the current political atmosphere, people are going to think, oh, that's Russia that Flynn was working for. Go ahead.
Well, right. And maybe the judge even had that misunderstanding, because we just keep hearing Russia, Russia, Russia. But you're right. If he was working for any other foreign power, it was Turkey, which is not an enemy of the United States, which, by the way, Russia is not either. But in any case, Turkey's a close ally of the United States. The idea that you could commit treason because you represent them on various issues seems silly. But as you say, this is going to now go down that he was somehow a traitor by giving something to Russia, and there's no evidence of that. Again, if there's any, if he was an agent of anyone else, it was of Israel, and he was lobbying for Israel with Kislyak, not for Russia. But all this is being obscured, and it's being obscured intentionally to continue to demonize Russia.
Colleen Raleigh, what do you think will happen with Michael Flynn? The sentencing was delayed. The prosecution had been basically saying he should be treated leniently because he's been cooperating so much with the Mueller probe. Then the thing that became odd at the end was, after all of this cooperation, 19 separate interviews between Flynn and the Mueller team, Flynn was also making the argument in his pre-sentence filing that he was basically tricked into pleading guilty, that he hadn't done anything wrong, that he had been entrapped. So you had the Flynn team sort of saying two things. Yes, we want to cooperate, we want to help, but we were tricked. At first, we thought Emmett Sullivan was kind of sympathetic because he is a judge known to be upset with and willing to take action about prosecutorial misconduct. In the case of Republican Senator Ted Stevens' case, it's not that he was necessarily innocent, but Judge Sullivan threw Ted Stevens' case out because he said that the FBI, which at that time was under the leadership of Robert Mueller, was keeping exculpatory evidence, meaning evidence that would be helpful to the defense, from the defense. Given all of these things, what do you expect now?
Well, I think Flynn has probably told them everything he already knows. And so the notion that these additional months now before sentencing are going to lead to some quote unquote further cooperation on his part, I think is probably not true. My guess is that he has told them about, for instance, his lobbying on behalf of Turkey. And there have already been some charges of Turkish people with regard to what he told them about this. That's already been done. I don't think there is anything further he could call. Maybe, you know, it's possible he's withheld something else from them, but I doubt it. I bet he has fully cooperated. What this is about, my guess, is to keep him quiet for this ensuing time period here, where he doesn't go out, or his attorneys don't go out and continue this saying that he was tricked into lying to the FBI and he never intended. This is going to keep him silent in this intervening period. And Flynn must, of course, realize that, you know, this is what I have to do in order to have a chance at prosecutorial leniency. Let me just mention one more thing about registering as a foreign agent. Flynn was doing something by not registering as a foreign agent that so many others were not registered as well. And especially, as you say, with representing a country that was considered to be an ally, a NATO member ally, I don't think very many of these revolving door generals and Congress people were registering. In fact, many of them, including Ted Olson just recently, the former Solicitor General, after they saw Flynn being prosecuted for failure to register, all quickly ran to register because they now think, oh, man, I could get in trouble. Before this, in the old days, if you didn't register as a foreign agent, especially for an ally, I think the most they would do was send you a friendly letter telling you that you should register. And so nobody much worried about it until Flynn got charged.
Very, very important perspective there from Colleen Raleigh. We're also speaking to Dan Kovalik. Dan, I think Colleen's argument or her suggestion makes so much sense, because Mike Flynn had these dual messages. One, yes, I'm willing to cooperate, but two, I was tricked. I was entrapped by the FBI. If the judge had extra or additional or ex parte communication with the prosecution in the last week, and they convinced the judge, hey, Judge Sullivan, you're setting us up so that Mike Flynn, after the sentencing, can go out and trash us and undercut the Mueller probe. What Sullivan did today, which was completely unexpected, accusing Flynn basically of being a traitor, but again, not letting people know it's about not filling out a form about his lobbying on behalf of Turkey. That's designed to keep Michael Flynn shut up. I mean, I think that's the only conclusion you can draw
exactly
to this.
Right.
It's like, do not do anything in the coming months that's going to upset the Mueller probe. Dan Kovalik, you get the last word.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I also think it's part of, frankly, continuing the news cycle about Russia. I mean, Mueller has very little on the Russian collusion issue. Even news outlets like NPR have conceded there's very little there. And so he wants to continue at least keeping Russia and the Trump administration together in the public eye. And I think that's what this is a lot about.
Yeah, I agree. John, you know, I don't think we're going to hear a lot more from Michael Flynn or his lawyers about how he was tricked or entrapped or set up.
Not a word between now and March.
And afterwards still. I think the message to all is zip it.
That's right.
Do not complain, even if you are the target, the victim of an entrapment, which it seems to me, in my mind, this is a key moment in understanding the Mueller probe, because why would you go with the National Security Advisor, and we're not fans of Mike Flynn.
No.
But 4 days in, why would you go when you had the transcript, you knew what he said to the Russian ambassador, why would you tell him, don't get a lawyer, just let's talk. He shows you around the White House, he's in a jocular mood, and then you bust him for not telling you the whole thing. Again, it's a setup. It seems to me a clear setup which goes to intent.
Indeed.
Not solving a problem, but intent, because they needed somebody or somebodies to be able to pin some sort of indictable offense so that the Russian probe could seem to have credibility. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent. Colleen, in 2002, was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He is the author of a new book called The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at jackrasmus.com. Our regular False Prophets guest, Daniel Sankey, is out sick today. We hope he gets better soon, but we're very, very honored to be joined by Dr. Rasmus. Jack Rasmus, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Glad to be here.
Jack, Goldman Sachs says get defensive for 2019 and buy high-quality stocks as recession fears rise. That's from CNBC. You've been suggesting, at least to us, and I think in your columns, that there is, in fact, a coming recession. Will it be a big recession?
Well, it all depends whether it's synchronized globally. And of course, Europe now is latest third quarter stagnant, growing at 0.2% and going to slow down even further. And it may be quite a slowdown in Europe if the Italy situation does not resolve itself. And if the Brexit is a hard Brexit, both of those look like it's getting worse. Germany is already contracting in some indicators. So Europe is the sick boy of the global economy first. Japan's already in recession. China is slowing rapidly. Key emerging markets are deeply in recession and financially in crisis. And then, as I've been saying, the real U.S. economy is slowing fundamentally. And I've been predicting for over a year now that there's going to be a recession in 2019 in the U.S. So it depends upon whether all those get synchronized, and it looks like it may be. Whether we have a financial crisis overlaid on top of this, we've yet to see. We have financial asset markets, prices deflating everywhere, which is an ominous sign. And finally, we got some of the mainstream talking heads beginning to raise the likelihood that there will be a recession. Certainly, if the Fed continues raising interest rates, I've been saying for the past year that the Fed cannot raise interest rates more than one more time, which would be December. If it does, it will really precipitate the recession earlier and more seriously. So my bet is the Fed will not raise interest rates after December. The Federal Reserve precipitates recessions, you see. It precipitated the 2008 crash. Didn't cause it, but provoked it, accelerated it by raising interest rates too high too long. Well, it's been doing the same thing here, although the rates are about half of what they were, meaning the U.S. economy is far more fragile than it was in 2007. So all those factors will determine, and if they converge, how soon we get a recession, how deep it is, and whether we have a financial crisis overlay.
Jack, I have to ask you, what's the incentive for the Fed to raise interest rates right now if we're on the edge of a recession? Wouldn't they want to keep the money supply sort of freely moving?
Well, if you you assume that the main purpose of the Fed is to stabilize the price system, which has always been a phony objective and target, I've never believed that. What the Fed, why the Fed is raising rates is because it has to sell $1 trillion or more of bonds this year in order to make up for the Trump deficit, which is caused by the massive $1 trillion plus Trump tax cuts and defense spending hikes. That's why we have this $1 trillion deficit for as long as the eye can see here going out. That's what the Fed has to do. It has to entice borrowers to buy treasury bonds, massive amount of treasury bonds. And that's why it's been raising interest rates, I believe. It has nothing to do with inflation because there's no inflation. It never has anything to do with inflation. It's to pay for the deficit. And by the way, that huge deficit that we got from the tax cuts, right? Where is it going? It's not going into the real economy. Where it's been going is buying back stocks and paying out dividends, which now will reach a record level, according to J.P. Morgan Research, even of $1.3 trillion, maybe more. Of stock buybacks. In other words, all this tax cut, which boosted bottom line profits 22% for the S&P 500, is being distributed to shareholders. You know, $1.5 trillion maybe this year. And that's why you're not getting the growth. It's not going into real investment. They're paying each other off.
Jack Rasmus is our guest. Jack is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California. He's the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. And we're talking about Goldman Sachs also suggesting to people who are its clients, people who it's investing their money, that to be defensive, meaning it's not going to be rosy, the stock market and other equities may be in decline. Certainly, the big swoon of the stock market in the last month has taken away all of the earnings from the past year. The stock market is in aggregate now down 2% after having surged all year, during which time Donald Trump claimed credit for the stock market.
Yep.
He said, you know, it's an indicator of what a brilliant political leader is. Now it's swooning. I think he'll try to distance himself from the stock market and say it's really the Federal Reserve.
It's the Fed's fault, yeah.
So it's the blame game. But aside from the blame game, Jack Rasmus, it seems to me that there we need to address a core question, because there's no issue more vital to everyone's life than the state of the economy. And every year we talk with economists like yourself or politicians or with each other, and we all say to each other, do you think there will be a recession next year? Do you think stock markets might crash next year? We live in an economy where there is an assumed unpredictability, or an assumed inevitability of unpredictability, or an assumed depression where people have to be laid off, and some people have to lose their homes, and you know, some jobs will be lost forever. And yet, it doesn't have to be this way. It's not like God mandated that we have a system that has recessions and depressions every 7 to 10 years. This is part of a particular economic system that has not always existed in the past, and consequently, we must assume won't always exist in the future. Why? Why do we have this kind of level of unpredictability?
Well, it's not so unpredictable.
No, I mean from year to year, like where you don't know whether the economy is going to tank next year.
Yeah, well, You know, what you're reflecting is the confusion of mainstream economics and economists. Very clearly, the big capitalists and finance people know that you can't go 10 years of subsidizing, first through the central bank, the monetary policy, subsidizing corporate profits. And then when that game was played, Trump turns and, the politicians turn to subsidizing corporate profits through massive tax cuts for investors and corporations. And you have these 10 years of record profits, and record profits drive up prices to bubble levels, as we've seen through stock buybacks and dividend payouts and so forth. They all know it was coming at some time, and that the Trump bump here, you know, the freebie of $4 trillion, you know, would run its course as well. And they've been all preparing, and it's just they knew it was going to happen. They just didn't know exactly when or how fast or how strongly. You see, people, who really understand the system, and I'm talking about the finance capitalists themselves, they're not so confused. You know, now they see the writing on the wall, and they're telling all their shareholders to change the cash because they know it's coming.
Well, the other thing is, if a recession comes, they may lose some of their wealth, but they're not going to be homeless. Right now, I was just looking and I was talking with John and the other people on the staff. The number of homeless people in the United States went up in the last year, and it went up again the year before that. That was during the economic expansion. Now, if there's going to be a big recession, there's going to be a lot more homeless people. In New York City, one out of every 10 kids in New York City public schools, this is the actual fact, are homeless. One out of every 10. What I'm asking is why should a certain number of people be expected to be, or why is it okay that a certain number of additional people are going to be made homeless next year as a consequence of an economic system or an economic order where, yeah, the finance capitalists know it's coming, but the rest of the country just kind of waits with bated breath about what their future looks like, and their future isn't going to be that good if another recession comes.
Agreed. That's the way the system moves, you see. It moves by fits and starts. It has a crisis created by excess greed and profits, excess profit-taking and other destabilizing practices. And then you have a crisis, and then the institutions of policy step in, and they bail out those at the top. They don't bail out the rest of society here. And they hope that those at the top getting bailed out will trickle a little bit down to the rest, and everybody will eventually recover. Well, the recovery has been very, very weak and uneven, skewed to the top, even of the labor market. You know, wages rising only for the top 10%, and the rest are still going backwards. And then they make money off of the recovery itself. You know, the Federal Reserve subsidizes trillions and trillions of dollars. The banks and the systems actually just paid the investors off who had losses, but didn't bail out the rest of us. And as I said, when that monetary policy game is over, well, then they switch to fiscal policy, i.e. the massive tax cuts, and they keep the game of subsidization. You see, policy is about subsidizing corporate profits and investor incomes. That's what fiscal monetary policy is about. That was what my book, Central Bankers at End of Rope, was about on the monetary side. And my forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, is about how fiscal policy and trade policy also play that same subsidization game. It's not about stabilizing the system. It's about making money off of the system in boom periods and in bust periods. And the state, the government, is playing a bigger and bigger role in the 21st century in that whole shell game.
Dr. Jack Rasmus is our guest. Dr. Rasmus is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California, the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. And Rasmus is R-A-S-M-U-S. So it's jackrasmus.com. Jack, I want to ask you another question. The government's intervention in the 2008 economic crisis was clearly pivotal. Certain banks had a circle drawn around them. They were declared to be too big to fail. They were saved. They had huge amounts of money pumped in. There was $660 billion as part of the TARP program that was allocated, no strings attached, no money, no accounting really fully required in terms of how that money was spent. That was given to the biggest banks. Some of the biggest corporations like General Motors also bailed out, union contracts eviscerated and redone so that workers had lower wages. The government intervened. It made all of that happen. It also engaged in quantitative easing. I can remember in March 2009, a month, 6 weeks after Obama took office, the stock market hit its bottom, which was 6,600. I talked to my friends and said, shouldn't we buy Citibank stock because it's worth about a dollar a share right then, just as a joke, of course. And now we have a stock market that surpassed 25,000. So an increase, a magnitude of a four, most of it during the Obama administration, some of it during the Trump administration. That was as a consequence of quantitative easing, as I understand it. In other words, the government printed money, gave the money to the banks. The banks could then gamble with it on the stock market. If there is another recession, does the easing of credit or the printing of money and giving it to the banks, like vis-a-vis quantitative easing or zero interest rates or sub-zero interest rates, is that a tool that's still in the toolbox of the Federal Reserve and the government?
Yes, and they will do it again on an even more massive scale, and it will have even less of effect than it had the last time because the amount of debt out there is $20 trillion higher than it was in 2007-2008. It was the central bank, the Fed, that bailed out the banks. It wasn't the $660 billion. Banks like Citibank and Bank of America were technically bankrupt and should have been rolled over, but they were subsidized, as you said, and a whole bunch of other financial institutions and investors were subsidized in the U.S. to the tune of at least $6 trillion. And what happened in the next 10 years was the banks and businesses bailed out. Globally, it was a $25 trillion bailout if you put in all the other central banks. And what did they do? They for 8 years, they gave themselves $1 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. And now it's more than $1 trillion. They've been just passing money created by the Federal Reserve to all their shareholders. And now that game is coming to an end. They don't have as much of a cushion to lower interest rates. Interest rates are having less and less effect on the real economy. And yes, they will engage in QE again, but my prediction is it will not have even as much effect on bailing out the banks. What will happen, I predict, is that if that's not sufficient, they will bail in the rest of depositors. In other words, they're already preparing to do this. They've always said they will do this. And that is if the banks are belly up, if you have money in the banks, right, they will convert your deposits in the banks into worthless bank stock. That's called a bail-in. So that's what's coming next time.
Just help us understand real quick how that works. I mean, in other words, when you deposit your money in the bank, you have a federal guarantee that money, no matter what, is going to be able to come back to you so that people don't panic and take all their money out of the banks at the same time. In other words, a run on the banks has happened in earlier depressions. Are you saying that federal loan guarantee will be sort of transferred into simply a, instead of giving you cash, giving you some sort of piece of paper that's an IOU that says the government will cover this, but it's actually not your money?
If you have more than $150,000 or $250,000, whatever the FDIC limit is, they'll probably raise that. Anything over that will get bailed in, potentially. In other words, if you've got $1 million, let's say, in deposits or investments, whatever, the government will, we'll honor the FDIC, the $250,000, whatever the limit is. But anything over that, or a portion of that, probably beginning before everything, will be bailed in. In other words, you will get the rest over $250,000 in the stock in the bank. That's what will happen.
That has to completely kill any thoughts of investor confidence, though, in the near and medium term, don't you think? I mean,
well, they actually did that in Cyprus, right? And the European Union was prepared to do that in Greece. They didn't implement it. But whenever there are profits to be made after the crash of all the values, the capitalists come back and they invest again. You know, some of them die off, some of them disappear, but those that have been successfully able to devour their competitors, they come back and they make even more money.
Last question, Jack Rasmus. Cyprus and Greece are on the periphery of the world economy. The U.S. is at the very heart of the world economy. If the U.S. bankers or the U.S. Federal Reserve uses Cyprus or Greek methods of preventing a complete and utter collapse of the system at the heart of the global economy, not at its periphery, it would seem to be a profound new stage of, well, world economy, but maybe world politics. And as John Kiriakou was suggesting, a shake to its very foundations, the confidence that people have. And confidence would seem to be all important, especially if you're saying the economy is now running basically on $20 trillion in debt. The idea is that the debt will be repaid, meaning confidence isn't simply a psychological state. It's a fundamental part of the business equation. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, in terms of the total debt, the $21 trillion is only the federal government, and that's going to $33 trillion over the next decade. You've got tens of trillions more of financial corporate debt, and that's because of the low interest rates. They've loaded up on this massive amount of debt to non-financial corporations. That's where the crisis is going to focus next, on non-financial corporations. And then you've got households, U.S. households, $13.5 trillion in debt. So the total debt is well over $50 trillion. It's not $20 trillion here. I didn't make up this bail-in idea. U.S. and U.K. Representatives have quietly, of the central banks, have quietly gotten together and indicated this. They even wrote white papers on it, that this would have to be done next time. And yes, it would deeply shake the confidence in the system, don't get me wrong. And who knows how long and how deep the crisis would go. They just don't know. And you see, the capitalists are playing it by ear to some extent. They don't have total control over this thing. They make a lot of money in creating the crisis, and then they get the state to bail them out, which alleviates the crisis. But the bailout of trillions of dollars creates the preconditions for the next crisis. You see, the solution is the source of the crisis. And no one knows next time around. Certainly, the Federal Reserve is not as well prepared. Interest rates are not 5.5% as they were in 2008. They're 2.75 at most, and there's not much leeway for them to lower interest rates. So we will get massive QE again. We may get bail-in. And who really knows how deep the crisis will go?
Dr. Jack Rasmus is our guest. Jack, I said the last question was our last question, but I do want to ask you one final question. At a time when industry, as you had mentioned, is some parts of the system, including the capitalist class, will take advantage of and even benefit from a recession or a depression. In other words, some of them will cash in. Partly what will happen also is that human labor, once laid off, will be replaced by machine labor or artificial intelligence, meaning a greater number of jobs each time a recession happens, they just don't come back, and they're being replaced with automation or with robots. It seems then a bigger and bigger part of the population is considered to be redundant or unnecessary labor. In other words, a part of the population that can't really buy, it can't purchase because it has no income. What happens to those people?
Oh, that's the other great question. My estimations are we have somewhere between 40, 50 million of unemployed and underemployed. In other words, part-time, temp, what's called contingent labor. A lot of them millennials, not making enough really to raise a family and be independent. We know that whole problem there. That's going to get significantly worse. The next phase is going to be to accelerate artificial intelligence, which, according to the McKinsey report, will negatively impact, wipe out 30% of the occupations by 2025. Now, a recession here will accelerate that, and it may come even earlier. But that means a lot of these contingent jobs, low decision-making jobs, service jobs, they will totally disappear. And then you're going to have massive tens of millions more underemployed and or unemployed. Yes, what's going to happen in mid-next decade to those tens of millions or more? I'm talking about 50, 60 million people, right? That's a big question. And certainly, you know, the two wings of the corporate party, America, the Democrats and Republicans, have no solution to this. Some are talking about universal basic income, but they'll never vote for that and allow that. So by next middle of next decade, we're going to be in a totally qualitative, different form of crisis here with massive problems in the labor market, not only massive problems in product markets and financial markets.
That's all the time we have. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California. He is the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Dr. Rasmus, what's the name of your new book?
The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump.
All right. That's the voice of Dr. Jack Rasmus. Go to www.jackrasmus.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.